Vice Marshal Johnson, Reel 2. Was that particular preference of attack shared by your brother pilots?
Yes, I think so, for the experienced pilots. But the average fighter pilot was, in those days, was a very poor shot. And he generally finished up in a line astern position, which was the most difficult position to bring anybody down, because you were flying straight into the back of the thing. And you've got to get through all the armour and all the sort of structure and so on and so forth. And there wasn't time during the war to teach, not until anyway the latter stage of the war, to teach people to shoot properly.
I've interviewed other people who were in the Battle of Britain who said that at that time very inexperienced pilots were being thrown into the fray.
I was one.
Did you found that yourself, did you, that there were some tragic losses because of that?
Well, I think so. I think if I'd have remained at Kenley in 1941 with my 10 hours on the Spitfire, hardly, I could just take it off and land it and fly it round the circuit. And if I'd have flown operationally from Kenley and the squadron, I don't think I'd be here today. Because I certainly couldn't fight the Spitfire. And you didn't really feel at home in it and master of it. I don't one with it until you'd done 50 hours in it. And the people who were coming to replace had done 10 and 12 hours, so they were slaughtered, really.
So really it was just a question of good luck that your squadron went to Curtin Lindsay?
Well, yes, which squadron you were posted to. I mean, most of the VRs who went down into the front line were killed.
When you took over as squadron leader, how did you take to the work as compared with what you'd been doing earlier? Did you enjoy it?
Do you mean the administrative work?
Well, all the work generally that you had to do as squadron leader.
Well, the squadron leader wasn't really much different from being a flight commander, except you had two flights and you had about 100 men under you. And it was a very satisfying job. There was very little administration. And it was basically a flying job. I mean, what administration was there was your adjutant looked after.
So you weren't drawn away from flying duties very much?
No, I think when I was a squadron leader, I flew more than ever.
And was it really flying? Was flying really the thing that you really wanted to do above all things in the RAF?
Yes.
What about the personnel that you had in 610 Squadron? Do any names and personalities stick out in your memory?
Yes, my fitter is a man called Arthur Radcliffe, who I see from time to time, and I shall see him again next month, and he lives along the road at Doncaster. And my rigger is a man called Harry Burton. I kept in touch with him for a long time, but he now lives in South Africa. But I see several of the personnel from time to time, yes. Because I think the RAF, I think you'd get it in no other service where an Air Vice Marshal would go out of his way, would you think, to meet his old rigger of 48 years ago. Or the rigger would go out of his way to meet the AVM. But we enjoy each other's company and regard it as participating in something together almost as equals, if that may sound a little trite. But he was as equally important, almost as important, to that aeroplane as I was.
What was the quality of the ground crew?
Excellent, first class. They were all pre-war chaps, you see, all volunteers. And although the pilots had changed and that sort of thing, And the County of Chester squadron no longer had any people from Cheshire in it. They were all Poles and Norwegians. The ground crew were all people still from Cheshire. The same as in the South Yorkshire squadron, they were all the people from South Yorkshire. They gave the squadrons the continuity.
How did these volunteer reserve squadrons compare with the RAF squadrons? Was there much difference?
Well, I had the volunteer, yes, there was no such thing as a volunteer reserve squadron. we were volunteer reservists who were posted into the RAF squadrons or the auxiliary squadrons. Is your question is how did the auxiliary squadrons compare with the service squadrons? The auxiliary, the weekend squadrons, which was a higher grade, if you like, socially than the volunteer reserve. We were weekend pilots. They were weekend squadrons, you know, formed from the county and that sort of thing. It was a certain social kudos in belonging to an auxiliary squadron pre-war. They weren't as good as the service squadrons, understandably, when war broke out, but I think after a year there was nothing in them. Because they didn't have the flying hours. But once, after a year or so, they were equally as good, if not better than some of the service squadrons.
How did your new station compare with Tangmere?
My new station in Norfolk was just a little satellite station where it was just Tangmere was a pre-war station. Ludham in Norfolk was merely a collection of huts on a meadow, really.
How do you spell Ludham?
L-U-D-H-A-M.
So a basic lack of facilities for you?
Sufficient. There was a mess and there was Nissen huts to sleep in and there were showers and ablutions and that sort of thing. Sufficient.
Can you describe the type of work that your squadron did in those days in 42?
Coming down to the south to take part in sweeps, coming down to the south to take part in Operation Jubilee, Dieppe, in August of 1942. Lots of convoy patrols, lots of attacks of shipping off the Dutch coast, and then intruder attacks over Holland in bad weather and moonlight.
Did you personally operate over the Dieppe raid?
Yes.
Can you describe in detail what you did?
The first day we flew as part of a wing. We joined up with two other squadrons and we flew as a part of the Wittering wing and we were top cover to the people going, the unfortunate soldiers going in down below.
Did you have to fight off any German aircraft?
Yes, we did, particularly on the first patrol, which, as I remember, was about 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning.
Can you describe how they attacked?
They were higher, and there were more of them, and they were rather vicious, and they got the Focke-Wulf 190, which was superior in all respects to our Spitfire 5.
What were the casualties on either side, if you can remember?
Our casualties were more than theirs. And of course on the ground it was just a disaster. We were supposed to be a headquarters ship, HMS Calypso it was called, and that was supposed to be the radar-equipped controlling ship. I could never establish communications with it on the four times we flew that day.
Why not? What was the problem?
I don't know, bad communications or the ship wasn't sunk, it was just impossible to communicate with it.
Were difficult communications often the case?
Not from the permanent airfields like Tangmere and the sector stations like Biggin Hill. The communications were quite good as a rule. This was supposed to be the controlling ship with RAF controllers on board who would give us instructions, but we never heard a thing from them all day.
What could you see of the Dieppe raid from where you were?
Well, we were so busy fighting to look after ourselves, really. We could see very little except a bloody great pall of smoke over the town. And lots of smoke and shelling going on down below, but we could do nothing about it because they were the attackers and defenders were all within 100 yards of each other. We couldn't help the army. We knew the army was in a bad, when we got home after the first patrol, we knew that the whole thing had been a disaster, but there's nothing we could do to help them.
Had your squadron been involved in the notorious case of the German warships which broke through the Straits of Dover in February 1942, when everybody was caught napping?
My squadron, where was I in 1942? Everybody was caught napping, and I happened to be on leave at the time. But my squadron, that was before I took over 610, and the squadron went off miles into the North Sea, but didn't see anything.
But you personally were on leave?
I was on leave, yes. But as you say, the whole thing was disaster, wasn't it?
Yes. Do any other incidents from those days in 42 stick out in your mind, which you can recount?
I think the turning, we could just begin to see the turning of the tide. The beginnings of the 8th Air Force were beginning to arrive in this country, and I forget when they started to bomb in daylight and so on and so forth, but one could just, even in those days, and that's the thing, there was a sense of optimism as Uncle Sam was building up and that sort of thing, that it was no longer a question of survival, it was only a question of time, really.
You mentioned the Focke Wulf 190. What kind of impact did it make when this new German fighter came on the scene?
We had established air superiority over the Channel and northern France and that sort of thing, which we lost to the Focke Wulf 190 when it arrived on the scene. Our operations were curtailed. We could no longer escort bombers across into northern France and Belgium.
Do you remember your first sight of one?
I had seen one in late 1941, and I'd reported it as a new type of aircraft with square wingtips and a radial engine, and I even drew a sketch of it. And somebody at the Air Ministry came back and told us that it was some French airplanes which the Germans had refurbished. And that was the Focke Wulf 190. So the Focke Wulf 190 took our intelligence services completely by surprise.
How was it that it came to be countered? With what kind of aircraft?
The Spitfire 9, which we were equipped with in late 1942, 1943, which was a much more powerful Merlin 61 engine, I think, which was over 2,000 horsepower, 2,040 horsepower it developed, was then a slightly better airplane than Focke Wulf 190. Slightly better. So you had this seesaw all throughout the war of one airplane having the slight edge over the other and that sort of thing. And the Spitfire 9 had that edge until the advent of the German jet aircraft, the 262, in 1944. But fortunately, there were not enough of them.
Did your squadron at this time in 42 take many casualties, do you recollect?
No. Few casualties through exuberant young people carrying out aerobatics too low and not pulling out and going into the ground and so on and so forth. But fewer casualties than the previous war, previous year, when we were going right over into northern France and that way.
You mentioned the coming of the Americans. What was your first contact with the American Air Force in Britain?
First contact, really, was, I think, in my logbook, which is not here, and I think we escorted just a few fortresses towards the end of 1940, either the end of 1942 or the beginning of 1943. And then as they built up, we began to sort of take them into France, Holland, and then eventually, you know, we were taking them in as far as we could on the great raids of August 1943 when they went right into Schweinfurt and Regensburg and so on. But with our limited range, we could only take them we could only go about as far as the Dutch border, and then they were on their own.
What was your own opinion of the American Air Force?
I thought that they set up the 8th Air Force against all the advice from the British air marshals, who said they couldn't bomb in daylight, because the British themselves, the bomber command, had been designed and equipped as a daylight bomber force, and because of our losses we'd had to go over to night bombing with all its indiscriminate area bombing and so on and so forth. And the Americans set out to bomb Germany by daylight and succeeded, eventually. And they succeeded because they maintained their aim and because of, at a very critical period, the Mustang P-51 came along and could escort them all the way to Berlin and back. And when Goering saw the P-51 in 1944, he said, "We've lost the war." And he was right.
How long were you doing the job as squadron leader of 610 Squadron?
610 Squadron, in the spring of 1943, I was promoted to Wing Commander Flying and went to Kenly to take over the Kenly Wing, which was two Canadian squadrons of the latest Spitfire, the Spitfire 9, which I've already told you about.
What did your duties involve there?
Mostly escorts to bombers, mostly escorting the 8th Air Force as it felt its feet over France, Holland, and eventually into Germany. And when we weren't escorting them, we were carrying out fighter ranging sweeps, perhaps 100 miles either side of the bomber stream.
Do any dogfights stick out in your mind from that?
Well, there was a lot of dogfights at that time, because although the majority of the Luftwaffe was in Russia, they withdrew some to resist the Americans. And I suppose I have seen several hundred German fighters in the air at one time in 1943. And then we had some very stiff fighting. And the Canadian wing, it was a particularly good wing. They were well trained. All the newcomers had at least 100 hours on Spitfires before they joined their squadron, so they knew all about the Spitfire. And we shot down a lot of German airplanes, and my own particular score went up from something like 8 or 9 destroyed when I joined them to 22 or 23 or 24 at the end of that tour in September of 1943.
Whereabouts generally were most of your successes?
All over France and Holland.
Were you ever brought down or seriously damaged yourself?
No. We had good control in then, we had good information, we had a very good aeroplane, better than anything the Germans could put up against us. As I said, we got very good information from our own radars up to about 200 or 220 miles distant. They told us when enemy formations were calling up, and you could position yourself and get into a nice attacking position and bounce the Germans. And also you knew that wherever the fortresses were, 1,000 fortresses, they eventually built up to 1,000 fortresses and B-24s, that there were German airplanes somewhere in the vicinity, somewhere you'd find them. And they were tied to the bombers there, so if you came in high, you could sort of split your force up and sort of pick them off. So, from a hunting point of view, it was a good year.
What did you think of the calibre of the Luftwaffe pilots as the war went on? Did it change?
Yes, decreasing. Yes. They were good in 1940 and 41. I didn't see much against them. I didn't know much about them in 1940, but in 1941 they were very good. They were all the veterans from France, from Spain, and so on and so forth. But in 1943 and 44, they weren't the same calibre. I suppose they'd been hastily trained and thrown into battle, like we in 1940.
And the calibre of the RAF pilots?
Very good, you see, because we had the time, didn't we? We had the Commonwealth Wing. And I said people were coming to join their squadrons with 100 hours, 150 hours, whereas 3 years previously, I'd been thrown in with 10 hours. So these chaps could, I mean, all you've got to do is teach them the fighter combat, the tactics. The airplane, they know all about.
So as wing commander, you were getting as much flying in as you were with a squadron leader?
Yes, because every time the wing flew, I led it, unless I was on leave. Unless I was on leave, and it was all wing shows. You know, 24 aircraft, or sometimes two wings together, and so on. I didn't do convoy patrols anymore. We didn't do that. Not in the Spitfire 9s. That was left to the Spitfire 5 squadrons scattered round the thing. I think the great tragedy of 1943 was that, 1943, yes, was that as the Americans were taking all these heavy casualties, and they lost 20% of their force on Schweinfurt in August of 1943, and we had 100 squadrons sitting in England, 100 Spitfire squadrons who couldn't help them because they didn't have the range. And the Spitfire could have been given the range just like the Mustang, but the shorter-sighted air staff sort of said, no, we must keep it as a defensive fighter. And if you look at your history, that's the thing, it was Portal, the chief of the air staff, who made that decision. A thing we've always regretted.
What were you doing when the preparations for D-Day were being made?
We were trying to train ourselves from becoming rather a static air force into a tactical air force. That is, we were moving airfields about once a week. We moved from Digby in Lincolnshire down to Herne near Bournemouth, and then to a place called Funtington, and then to Tangmere, and then to Ford, everywhere, to get used to this sort of nomad existence of being on the move. And at the same time, we were carrying operations in May and the early part of June against a variety of targets on the in France, mostly transportation and the no-ball sites. You remember the sites for the V1s.
Which sites?
They were called no-ball sites, N-O-B-A double L. They were the launching pads for the V1s. And by this time we were hanging bombs in our Spitfires. They were fighter bombers because we were transformed from an air superiority force to a fighter bomber force.
Can you tell me what work you did actually at D-Day?
At D-Day, we did just the same as we did at Dieppe, really. We flew over the beaches four times. And it was a very... the cloud was down to about 1,500 or 2,000 feet. And we flew up and down the British and Canadian beaches. Personally, we didn't see an enemy aircraft that day, although some other wings did. My main job was to avoid running into the thousands of other aircraft that were over there, you know, from the 8th Air Force and the 9th Air Force and the bloody Navy and the Free French and so on and so forth. And we didn't see an aircraft at all that day. And then on D plus 3, the commander who was commanding the forces, the fighter forces, rang me up and said, would I land on an airfield at a place called Saint-Croix-sur-Mer, which our people had built, would I send a section to see if it was ready? It was okay. So on D plus 5, I took the whole wing into Saint-Croix-sur-Mer in Normandy. And there we operated from there as a tactical air force until the end of the war.
So you were doing strafing attacks against ground targets?
We did both things. When the Luftwaffe was in the air, as it often was in Normandy and across the Seine, and from time to time, the Ardennes, there was a lot about, they put up 500 or 600, didn't they, on January the 1st. We operated as fighters. When we weren't operating as fighters, we operated as fighter bombers with bombs or Struff. And personally, I didn't like bombing. I thought it was rather degrading to put bombs on this nice, clean Spitfire of mine, and so on and so forth. So I did as little as possible.
Apart from that, what was your main objection to bombing?
I didn't see why that I'd survived the war since 1940, and I didn't want to be shot down by some kraut with a bloody little machine gun on the ground. My philosophy was I didn't mind being shot down by Mr. Gallen or Herr Gallen in a good clean fight at 20,000 feet, but not by some ignorant bugger on the ground with his little 303 rifle. That didn't appeal to me at all.
But was there much chance of being shot down?
Oh, yes, there was, because the German flak was very, very accurate. And a lot of pilots, particularly Typhoon pilots, were killed in Normandy.
But you were still flying Spitfire 9s,
were you? We were still flying Spitfire 9s, which wasn't really... It wasn't really a ground attack aircraft. I mean, it had a little coolant tank in front of it here, just under the chest and that sort of thing, and one bullet in the coolant tank would bring you down. You wanted a more rugged airplane like the Typhoon or the Tempest, which they did great work in Normandy, and I hope you've got some Typhoon or Tempest pilots on tape for this thing.
Not as much as we should have, I'm afraid, but... you were still wing commander at this time.
Still wing commander of the Canadian wing, yes.
Do you remember any specific targets which you attacked at that time?
There was quite some stern fighting, air fighting from time to time, and particularly when they reacted, we would go on freelance patrols. I'd take a squadron, not a wing, and. Because a squadron was a little more flexible than a wing, and we found that because of the speed of our fighting, the formations were tending, had built up to big wings in 1941, 2 and 3, and now, because of the increase in speeds, the tendency was towards smaller formations. So I said I'd lead a squadron in Normandy, and so on, and very often we came across a dozen, 15, 20, 109s and 190s. We had some very stiff fighting from time to time, and particularly over Falaise when the 7th Army was trapped, and particularly a day or two later when the Germans were trying to get the remnants of the 7th Army across the Seine. That would be about towards the end of August of 1944.
Did you have anything to do with Arnhem?
No, we had nothing to do with Arnhem, and I was, at the time of Arnhem, I was stationed at a place called Brussels Aver, and I was coming back to, we'd done an offensive patrol over the Rhine one Saturday afternoon, or it may have been a Sunday afternoon, I think it was a Saturday afternoon, and we were coming back to Brussels, and I saw hundreds of transports, Dakotas, hundreds of them, some of them towing gliders, flying towards Arnhem. And I went and had a look at them to make sure they were American. And that was the first I knew about the Arnhem, as a wing commander, I knew about the Arnhem operation, which had all been planned from London. And we hadn't, or it hadn't been integrated with, not down to my level at all. Which was scandalous, I thought, really.